On This Week in Enterprise Tech, Panera has baked up a hot batch of fail. Mariah is banking. CenturyLink has no customers. And Wilson Electronics stops by to explain the future of wireless is 5G. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 285, recorded April 6, 2018. The future of mobile connectivity is 5G. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Eero. Never think about Wi-Fi again with Eero's hyper-fast, super-simple Wi-Fi system. And now the second generation Eero is tri-band and twice as fast. For free overnight shipping to the United States or Canada, visit Eero.com, select overnight shipping at checkout, and enter the code ENTERPRISE. And by LastPass. Join over 13 million LastPass users and start managing and securing your passwords today. Learn more at LastPass.com/twit. Welcome to Twyatt This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professionals, the IT pros, and the geeks who just want to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballasaire. A little bit sick, but always ready to bring you the enterprise goodness. And of course, if I'm going to bring you the goodness, I got to have my good, my great, my awesome co-host with me. And this week, we've got Mr. Lou Maresca, who has been promoted to head Jiren over at Microsoft. Lou, it's good to see you, my friend. How are you? And by the way, I just heard there's another Maresca on the way.
Yes, yes, number four is coming, and it could be any day. We're looking forward to it.
Well, you know, there's things that you celebrate in life. Of course, the birth of a new child and another Twyatt episode. So yeah, I think they're just about the same. It's good to have you. Also with us is, he's the man from the East. He's Curtis Franklin. Curtis, how are you, and how's the house search?
Well, interestingly enough, we do think we've got a house identified. We should know sometime this month whether it's going to be the location of the new East Coast Twyatt studio. We'll let everyone know, but it looks like Orlando has another resident, and we are excited about that.
Fantastic. Well, gentlemen, we've got a fun show for our audience. Not only are we going to be doing a little bit of the modern news, the contemporary news, the blips, and a bite or two, but we're also going to be talking about 5G and what it might do for the mobile enterprise. We've got a guest from Wilson who's going to drop all the knowledge, but as we always do, we have to kick it off with the blips. Now, Krebs on Security is back on the case, and this time they're delivering Panera Bread Company a hot, flaky batch of network shame. On his blog, Brian Krebs details the leak of millions of customer records, including names, emails, addresses, birthdays, partial security numbers, and other personally identifying information through an embarrassingly simple vulnerability in the PaneraBread.com site. How simple? Well, by appending a few database search strings to the end of the Panera delivery URL, anybody on the internet could search through the Panera user database as if they were a legitimate, authorized database admin. Unfortunately, that's not the worst of the story. The researcher who found the vulnerability, Dylan Houlihan, initially notified Panera about the leaky site back on August 2nd, 2017. Because he's a security professional, he asked for a public PGP key so that he could send full details of the weakness to the Panera security team. In response, Mike Gustafson, Panera's Director of Information Security, accused Houlihan of running a shakedown scam, insulted his integrity, and basically told him to go stuff himself. That was despite the fact that Houlihan never asked for payment, never insinuated a threat, and never wrote anything other than professional correspondence. Eventually, Gustafson provided a PGP key, and 7 days later, the Panera exec ended the communications by writing, quote, "We're working on it," unquote. That was 8 months ago, and the vulnerability persisted until Krebs finally published his blog, and Panera was shamed into acting, kinda. They fixed the vulnerability by requiring a user to be logged in before they scanned the entire database. Then a little further shaming finally got them to actually secure the database. Panera also claims that fewer than 10,000 customers were affected, but Krebs later tweeted links showing that the breach touched the records of 37 million. There's going to be a lot of back and forth, but I'm pretty sure we can't trust anything coming out of the Panera C-suite security at the moment.
We've all dealt with chatbots. They really aren't fooling anybody with robotic and predictable responses, or are they? Normally, chatbots are not conversational. Most of the time, they're limited to canned responses and aren't capable of initiating new conversations on their own. If you remember back in 2014, Bing released Zhao Ice for Windows Phone. In order to develop Zhao Ice, Bing indexed over 7 million Chinese conversations online to ensure it sounded natural, idiomatic, and human. Users can talk to Zhao Ice about anything, and it can respond in such an emotional way that people can feel Zhao Ice is a real human person. Zhao Ice uses machine learning to gather information about popular topics of the day, such as TV shows or celebrities. Based on training data, she can actually get information from publicly available social chatter as well. She also can build memories, such as birthdays or astrological signs, that she can bring up in later conversations with individuals. What is the breakthrough now? Well, Zhao Ice now operates in full duplex mode, or two-way conversation mode, which is not like the previous walkie-talkie-like half duplex interactions. Full duplex reduces the time it takes for the bot to respond, making it feel more like a natural conversation. Sooner than later, you might chat with a customer service agent and they will actually solve your problem and genuinely thank you, and you will have no idea that you're talking to a machine.
Well, Mirai is back, and this time it's going after the banks. This week, Insight Group, the threat research group within Recorded Future, found that a Mirai botnet variant was used in late January to attack companies in the financial sector, and it might not have been alone. They found that it was possibly linked to both the IO Troop and Reaper botnets. On January 29th, ABN AMRO, which is a Dutch bank, reported that they had been hit by a DDoS attack the previous day and that other Dutch banks had also been hit. Insight Group says that the DNS amplification attack used by one of the first targets hit 30 gigabits, which was highly disruptive but far from the largest DDoS attack we've seen. The botnet used against ABN AMRO was 80% made up of MikroTik routers and 20% by various IoT devices, everything from Apache and IIS web servers to webcams, DVRs, TVs, and other smaller routers. The analysts say that while many of the devices used in the attacks were previously available for use in other botnets, many of the others were not known to be subject to existing botnet malware. Botnets are still out there. The IoT networks are getting larger and more complex, pretty much guaranteeing that this won't be the last time the name Mirai comes across on the threat reports.
Now, a lot of tech companies have been talking about making big moves in the Internet of Things space with a few products and services released over the last 4 years. But a little company in Redmond seems ready to go all in by making IoT a central part of their kinder, gentler, more cloud-based Microsoft. On Wednesday, VP of Azure, Julia White, announced in a blog post that Microsoft would be investing $5 billion into IoT over the next 4 years. Though she was shy on details, she did let loose that we should expect the investment to hit cloud, OS and devices, as well as their partner devices and programs. 4 years is a long time in this industry, but in the near term, I wouldn't be surprised to find Cortana becoming more IoT-friendly and ubiquitous across Microsoft IoT. Of course, it wasn't just a blog post. Also on Wednesday, Microsoft announced a new basic version of Azure IoT Hub, which provides connectivity, provisioning, and management services to IoT devices. Whereas the previous S1 tier on Hub had cost $50 per unit per month for 400,000 messages a day, those who want to experiment with IoT can now get basic with 400,000 messages a day for $10 per unit per month. Since it's all in the Azure IoT Hub family, there are now a lot more tiers for IoT developers to appropriately size their deployments.
For just mere $51,000 worth of Bitcoin, the city of Atlanta was brought to its knees with the latest ransomware attack that scrambled their files with a digital key. This one is a step above last year's hack on Dallas, Texas, where hackers gained the ability to set off tornado sirens in the middle of the night. Although the entry hasn't been identified yet, files were locked down with encryption, with their names temporarily changed to "I'm sorry." Hackers gave Atlanta a week to pay off before the files were permanently made inaccessible. Atlanta-based security firm Dell SecureWorks helped the city respond to the ransomware attack and was able to identify the assailants as the SamSam hacking crew. SamSam was one of the most prevalent and meticulous of the ransomware attack groups. The SamSam group is known for the choosing targets that are, were the most likely to accede to its high ransom demands. Most of the city's major systems were not affected, including 911 calls and control of wastewater treatment. But other systems were down for days. The Atlanta Municipal Court was unable to validate warrants. Police officers had to actually write reports by hand. The city even stopped taking employment applications. This attack is just another warning shot across the bow of organizations and businesses to say, secure your networks, back up your data, and stop paying for ransoms for ransomware and make it less profitable. Once the profit horse is gone, profiteers will stop betting on it.
Misconfigured clouds made up 424% more of the records lost in 2017. Now, according to new data from IBM X-Force, insider mistakes like network backup incidents and misconfigured cloud servers caused nearly 70% of all compromised records in 2017. And these types of incidents affected 424% more records last year than in the year prior. There is some good news, though. Researchers found 2.9 billion records were reported breached, which was nearly 25% less than reported in 2016. Now, it's not like the bad guys are going away. Hackers are just changing their strategies, researchers say, swapping data breaches for ransomware. Most common class of attack vector in 2017 was injection attacks, which accounted for about 79% of malicious activity on enterprise networks, which was nearly double from the previous year. Why the increase? Well, because both botnet-based command injection local file inclusion attacks and command injection attacks use embedded coin mining tools, and, well, cryptojacking is growing like gangbusters. The hidden baddie in all this is simple error. IBM researchers report poorly configured systems were responsible for exposing more than 2 billion records that X-Force tracked in 2017.
Now, let's say that your company is caught overbilling, false charging, and otherwise defrauding millions of its customers. You could apologize and promise to make amends. You could agree to a special third-party investigation to get to the bottom of the fraud. Or, if you're CenturyLink, you could just try the, we don't actually have customers, and therefore it was impossible for you to for us to defraud them, defense. CenturyLink, one of the United States' largest ISPs, made the curious legal claim as they are trying to find protection from a class action lawsuit from customers in 14 states, who claimed that the company, one, sold services at one rate but billed at a higher rate, two, billed customers for services not ordered, not delivered, or canceled, and three, created fake and duplicate accounts and then attempted to collect early termination fees on those accounts. In response, CenturyLink didn't deny the fraud, but instead they claimed that sole defendant CenturyLink is a, quote, parent holding company that has no customers, provides no services, and engaged in none of the acts or transactions about which the plaintiffs complain, unquote. Instead, CenturyLink has set up a series of shell companies out of which those services are provided by CenturyLink. And as those companies have arbitration-only clauses in the contracts, lawsuits should be dismissed. Furthermore, CenturyLink argues that the fake accounts fake agreed to the real arbitration, so therefore they have no legal standing for real. Now, if that sounds familiar, it's because Wells Fargo tried using that exact same tactic in their fraud case. Unfortunately, while the binding arbitration trick was on its way out, in large part because of the disaster that was Wells Fargo, that trend was reversed last year by the presidential executive order on reducing regulation and controlling regulatory costs, long name, signed on January 30th, 2017. That argued that arbitration would be better for the consumers. So let's see how that works out. That does it for the blips. Next up, we're going to be jumping into the bites. But first, let's go ahead and take a moment to thank a sponsor of this week in enterprise tech. Now, let me ask you something. Do you like your Wi-Fi? Of course you do. I mean, I remember a time. And in fact, I believe most of our audience remembers a time before Wi-Fi and when it was a curiosity. But Wi-Fi has become ubiquitous. It's become something that we expect. It's become something that supports all of our devices, our phones, our laptops, our entertainment gear, our gadgets, our gizmos, the things that we love. So when your Wi-Fi doesn't work right, well, it's frustrating. Well, what if I told you that there was a way to have great Wi-Fi, enterprise-grade Wi-Fi, throughout your home, throughout your small office? And it could be done in such a way that it is so easy to set up that you just need an app on your phone. Well, folks, that's not a dream. That's not a fantasy. That's Eero. Oh, this episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Eero, that lets you install an enterprise-grade Wi-Fi system in your home in just a few minutes. You simply download the Eero app on your iOS or Android device, and it will walk you through each step of the installation process. It's quick, easy, and it's painless. You can easily create and share a guest network for those people who come in that you want to give temporary access to, but you don't always want them to be able to jump on. Now, you can also know how many devices are connected to your network at any given point. You can check the internet speed that you're getting from your service provider. You could find out which devices on your network are using up all the bandwidth at all the wrong times. Now, Eero is also protected with state-of-the-art WPA2 encryption, so your comfort and ease doesn't have to come at the expense of security. Now, they've also got the second-generation Eero and Eero Beacon. Now, they started home Wi-Fi systems in early 2016, and they haven't sat still. Since then, they've learned from hundreds of thousands of systems, making them smarter, faster, and more reliable. And with all that knowledge, they created the second generation. The Eero second generation and Eero Beacon allows a customer to build a Wi-Fi system that's more perfectly tailored to their home and their devices. Now, they offer more speed and more range in the exact same high-quality, elegant design that people have come to expect from Eero. With the addition of a third 5 gigahertz radio, the second generation Eero is now tri-band and twice as fast as its predecessors. That means that you can do more simultaneously in every room of your home. And with the addition of the new Thread radio, you may have heard of this. It's a piece of technology that allows your Wi-Fi system to interact with, say, the home automation gear you might buy. It means that Eero can now connect to low power devices such as locks, doorbells, and other sensors. Now, expanding your coverage in any room is really easy with the Eero Beacon. You simply plug it into a wall and you're covered. And you can add as many Eero Beacons as you want. That means that if there's an outlet, you've got Wi-Fi. How about that? Folks, stop putting up with bad Wi-Fi. Walk away from nasty networks. Try Eero. For free overnight shipping to the United States or Canada, visit Eero.com and at checkout select overnight shipping. Then enter Enterprise to make it free. That's Eero.com and enter the code ENTERPRISE. And we thank Eero for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's go ahead and jump into the bite. And this time, we got to talk about the blockchain. No. This is not another company that's trying to make billions just by adding blockchain to their name. No, it's not another ICO. And no, it's not just another technology that tacks on blockchain into the PR release. This is all about something that I'm actually quite excited about, and that is using the blockchain to increase the security of provider data. Now, we have found in a story from CNET that a growing number of researchers are eventually finding that blockchain, real blockchain, not just a cryptocurrency technology, but the actual process behind creating a blockchain could make sharing and accessing data more efficient. Now, on Monday, we had 5 major healthcare organizations, which include Optum, United Healthcare, Quest Diagnostics, MultiPlan, and Humana, and you've probably dealt with at least one of them, say that they are looking at integrating blockchain into their programs. In fact, they're all launching a pilot program to see if blockchain technology can keep health plan provider directories up to date and make sure that everything is HIPAA compliant. Now, I want to open this discussion with you, Curtis, because this is something that we've bantered back and forth about on Twite, which is anytime you touch healthcare data, things become a bunch more sensitive because of HIPAA regulations and because of the massive penalties that can be applied if a company does not do its due diligence to secure customer information, especially sensitive information like healthcare information. Blockchain is one of these things that once you get away from the hype and once you divorce it from cryptocurrency, it's actually a fantastic system both for the provider to verify the records and for the customer to have singular access to the records. Does this actually make sense? Do you think that these companies actually understand what they're getting into when they say we want to develop a blockchain pilot program?
You know, I think that they probably do. And I can think of a couple of ways that they can go about in doing it. The simplest, the most obvious, involves a technique called data obfuscation. That's basically where you take the data, run it through an algorithm that changes it into something that can be processed like the original data. but is not identifiable in any way back to the individual. Then when all of the processing is done, in this case, all of the blockchain magic that has to go on, it can come back to the original owner, be deobfuscated, and returned and used in its normal state. So it seems to me that if you're going to be going through this, and let me say now, I'm a big fan of blockchain for applications like this, then I think, you know, if I were doing it, obfuscation is the path I would walk down first.
Right, right. Now, Lou, there is another question that we have to ask here, and that is, you know, there has been a tendency, especially this last year, just to throw blockchain into the mix and say, okay, that's like a magic bullet. I'm not suggesting that that's what this is, but just using the blockchain doesn't automatically make things HIPAA compliant, right? I mean, HIPAA compliant has, there is a standard of security, and it's not just encryption, but there's also a division of what records are separate from what records. That still has to be addressed. I mean, just throwing everything in a blockchain doesn't make it better.
Right. I think that, you know, that's interesting because blockchain can do, just because it's distributed, it does make it more secure because things are kind of split up and again, makes it so that there's a single source of truth. So that's, again, really kind of a great thing. But again, like you said, HIPAA compliance is a big thing. And I think what will end up happening, and this is just kind of me kind of seeing what the future will hold with blockchain in healthcare, is the fact that most of these healthcare services or systems will essentially try to limit the network nodes for blockchain to more of a private-based network, because then it'll allow them to make sure that it can be HIPAA compliant. And then that way they can encrypt it and make sure it's encrypted in transit. And anytime it goes off the chain, it's encrypted. And so I think that will ensure all that. And so you won't necessarily see the whole advantage of blockchain up front, which is, hey, I own my data and I get to own it, and then I get to give it to these healthcare systems when I want to. And I don't think that that's going to happen up front. I think it's going to be the other way around. It's going to be more locked down, more secure, so it does meet these compliance. And then there'll be other systems that are allowed to kind of go out to the consumer themselves.
I like that. Yeah, actually, that's a very good way to look at it. Now, let's go ahead and give you an example of how this is supposed to work. Theoretically, there's two problems that they're solving for. One, that is the synchronization of data between all the providers, because that's actually a big problem, especially with HIPAA compliance and the fact that they have to keep such close tabs on the data. It's often not easy for organizations to share customer data because they're very, very concerned that they might accidentally violate HIPAA. Even an accidental HIPAA violation can cost them millions of dollars. On the patient side, they want to try to make records easier for patients to share. Right now, if you want to share your records between one doctor and another, it can be a little bit of a nightmare. Again, because of the HIPAA compliance issues, you do have to go to each doctor. You have to make sure that all the proper forms are signed. You have to make sure that the information is sent to the right place. And then you have to make sure that the receiving doctor is also HIPAA compliant. What they think they can do with the blockchain is, because they're going to have everything in this distributed ledger, A, they can verify which records come from which organization. So they're going to have a foolproof way to be able to do that. And they can synchronize data across those different records. And even after they're synchronized, they can always go back to show the original records. So that's great on the provider side. On the customer side, because it is your block, because it's your information, because you will have that particular block, you can share that block with a new doctor. That new doctor can look at the blockchain and verify that it came from the right sources, and therefore you reap the benefits as well. Theoretically, that's absolutely the way it's going to work. That's the way that they want it to work. That's the way they design it to work. They just now have to figure out how to actually make that work. Lou, Curtis, I'm going to throw over to either of you first. What could possibly go wrong? I mean, I know that's an open-ended question, but what's a bad outcome here?
Well, I think there are a number of bad outcomes, but I wanted to first, before I get to the bad news, look at one more thing where it could be some good news, and that is this blockchain. What if every one of the healthcare providers who touched your data had to be part of that chain? Now, I know a number of years ago when I had a major health issue, when I was getting the bills back from the hospital, I was seeing lots of doctors and specialists on there that I never saw. Now, I had to take their word that they had somehow touched my data and entered, you know, offered some sort of opinion or judgment on it. But if there's a blockchain that they have to touch, then if they actually look at the data, it's part of the chain. Mm. And if they don't, it's part of the chain. So I think that could be really good. Now, having said that, I can also imagine that on the bad side, it's only so long before some of the medical scam artists start building their own medical blockchain farms. And suddenly you get miners out there running blockchains, proving, they say, that they have touched data, done great things, when all it's done is hit a server that's sitting in a container with the big honking air conditioner hanging off the back.
Oh, my. You just had to bring that up, didn't you, Curtis? Thanks. I appreciate that. Lou, what about you? Do you have something doom and gloom for us?
Yeah. So I think another thing is the fact that, you know, I think Curtis kind of alluded to this, is members of the blockchain. So I think, you know, this is going to probably start in your local area where hospitals can kind of, you know, share data amongst themselves. But making this kind of, hey, I'm flying to New York and I'm going to the hospital or a doctor there, you know, can these particular providers also access that data? And most likely in the beginning, they're not going to be able to, because it's not going to be, they're going to be part of that kind of chain themselves. And so that becomes the fact that you're going to have to standardize this, and that might require some government intervention and some other compliance and other those types of things. So I think it's going to be a long road, and I don't think it's going to happen right away.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the thing. These companies saying that they are launching a pilot program to use the blockchain, it does not mean that blockchain technology is inevitable, nor does it mean that it's going to happen soon. These companies are healthcare companies. They will move very, very slowly because they understand the problems with moving quickly and messing it up, especially if you're dealing with patient information. But both of you make some very good points, and both of you have some very good ideas about how this is going to be used. Curtis, I love the idea of the digital fingerprints. Everyone who has touched any of your health information, anyone who has touched any of your health billing, gets recorded, and that can be verified across all the holders of the distributed ledger. That's fantastic. I mean, that's actually a really good idea, because it gives you, as the patient, the ability to sort of go back through your blockchain and say, okay, I recognize that. I don't recognize that. Let's find out where that came from. Although I guess that's probably just a step up from looking at your medical bill, because I've done that before and I couldn't understand anything that was put onto that record. So yeah, go figure. Gentlemen, I'd love to talk about this more, but I do want to give our guest a little bit of time, because we want to talk about 5G. Now, I know that you've heard a lot about 5G, folks. I know that it's been a buzzword for a very long time. We've been covering emerging 5G technologies for the last 3 years. We saw a demo from Intel that showed what it can do. But what does it actually really truly mean for the mobile enterprise? Well, we've got a guest from Wilson Electronics who's going to show us at least his vision of what 5G can do for you. But before we get to that, let's go ahead and take another moment to thank a sponsor of this week in Enterprise Tech. Now, we like security. We're not all Panera Bread. We can't just let our security carbs hang out. We like to make sure that our accounts are locked up. We like to make sure that we've encrypted our data. We like to make sure that we're not using the same password across all of our sites on the internet, because Monkey1234, or the combination for my luggage, 1234, isn't always the best way to go about securing your data. So why not make sure that you're using the best of breed, the best in class, and honestly, the best in practice way to secure your accounts? And of course, that means we have to talk about LastPass. Now, LastPass keeps your passwords organized and secure and right at your fingertips. Now, we all know that there are too many passwords to remember. Yes, we're Twiet. We're the Twiet Riot. So we understand what you should do. You should never reuse a password. You should cycle your passwords every once in a while so that if they do get breached, it doesn't affect that account for that long. And yes, of course, you never write anything down. But trying to do that in the modern world where you could have dozens, if not hundreds, of passwords, and it's impossible to remember them over time, means you're going to need a little bit of help. Now, LastPass makes that kind of help, that kind of password security, effortless. You just remember your master password, and LastPass remembers the rest. Now, if you're reusing the same password over and over, first, shame on you. Stop that. Second, LastPass generates and stores strong, unique passwords to keep you safe and secure. A LastPass automatically remembers and fills your passwords anytime, anywhere, whether you're on your computer or on a mobile device. You can explore your LastPass vault that lets you easily add, view, and manage items that you've saved. So you could even do a little bit of trimming. Go back through those accounts that maybe should be shut down. Maybe you don't want to be remembering passwords for anymore. A LastPass Enterprise simplifies password management for companies of every size with the tools that you need to secure your business while centralizing control of employee passwords and apps. Did you know, well, of course you know, you're twiet, that over 81% of breaches are caused by weak passwords? Yeah, it's not the most sophisticated attack. It's not some guy who's been hammering at your firewalls. It's some employee who's decided, good passwords are for someone else. LastPass protects every password in your business without slowing down your employees. LastPass makes password sharing convenient for employees while keeping access to corporate data secure. Now, sensitive data is encrypted at the device level with AES 256 to prevent man-in-the-middle attacks. Now, we've been using LastPass here at Twit, well, for as long as I've been at Twit. It's how we keep things secure. It's how we make sure that our people, our editors, and our engineers can get into the files that they need to get into at the same time without creating this sort of bubble of security that can be broken the first time someone writes down their password on a Post-it note. And LastPass has other products besides Enterprise for Business. There's LastPass Premium for personal use. There's LastPass Families for your entire family. There's LastPass Teams for teams of 50 or less. So here's what we want you to do. We want you to simplify your life. We want you to live the security life. We want you to try LastPass. At work and at home, fix your password woes with LastPass, the number one most preferred password manager. Learn more at LastPass.com/twit today. That's LastPass.com/twit and see which product is right for you. And we thank LastPass for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's go ahead and do my favorite part of the show. That's when we bring a guest in, an expert who can drop some knowledge on the Twit Riot. And today we welcome to the show Mr. Jeff Goodevish. He is the Chief Product Officer for Wilson Electronics. Jeff, thank you very much for joining us on This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Hi, Robert. Thanks. It's great to be here.
Now, Jeff, Wilson Electronics, for those who maybe haven't been paying attention, has been really active in the consumer space for years and years and years. I've seen them every year at CES. You will enable mobile electronics. You create signal boosters. You've done great work with RF design. That's sort of your thing. So tell me, what's your involvement with 5G?
Well, great question. And yes, we do have a long history of enhancing cellular signals. And so, you know, we really look at 5G as obviously the sort of the next evolution. You know, one of the enablers of why we're in business today is just the fact that we've all had those experiences where, you know, cellular signals attenuate or they decay as they go through buildings and structures and things. And so, you know, all this talk about 5G is exciting as it is. And I know there's lots of different paths and ways that a lot of the operators are getting there. But, you know, the real promise of 5G comes from the 5G NR, which is the 5G new radio standard. And so when these begin to move into millimeter wave networks, you know, the pure physics of it is as frequencies go higher and higher, the attenuation or the path loss and the deterioration of those signals is even more pronounced. And so, you know, since we are in the business of enhancing cellular signals and improving connectivity in buildings and in vehicles and inside of structures, you know, the need for enhanced cellular connection, whether it's a centimeter wave, cellular today, or even millimeter wave, as we see, is obviously going to become, you know, more and more important. And so we continue to look to fill the need there that we believe consumers will continue to have.
I'm glad that you brought that up because a lot of people don't see that trade-off, even though they should, because from their minds, wireless started with Wi-Fi, 2.4 gigahertz Wi-Fi, and then we went over to 5 gig, and they noticed that, yeah, the range wasn't as great. The speed was better, but it couldn't go through walls. It couldn't go through windows. The same thing happens, as you mentioned, as you get smaller and smaller wavelengths. You can get more data over them, but they don't penetrate. And so naturally, you're going to need something that can boost the signal. You're going to need something that can get it through walls. And as we move to 5G and, you know, those millimeter or centimeter wave technologies, the range drops off dramatically, right? I mean, how would it actually even work in a city? If you go into the middle of a densely populated metro area, what kind of gear do you need to make sure that a 5G device won't drop off every time it loses line of sight to the transmitter?
Exactly. And so, you know, there, the talk about true mobile 5G is really going to be a challenge. And so when we see network trials, and you talked earlier in the show about seeing demos, and, you know, the Olympics was one of those examples, right? So all these millimeter wave trials that are going on today, we really see that as it's going to be a fixed wireless access rollout to start. You know, you're going to, if you look at it, the mobile operators now have a technology that is essentially wireless fiber. And that's really what we all really crave and want in our handsets as we, you know, pull more and more data and video and things and applications, even some enterprise tools over our mobile devices. You know, the need for that connectivity and speed is even more so. But to answer the question, yeah, the challenges of distance, of building out, you know, a lot denser. We talk about, you know, dense networks on the cellular side. And so 5G is going to require, you know, a much more dense network at the macro level. And so, you know, it's really going to be what we see as a fixed wireless access. So you're going to have a you know, a base station or a picocell or a micro base station, you know, transmitting to buildings. And then you can distribute the signals, you know, like through Wi-Fi or wired once you get inside the building. But really it is going to be, we see fixed wireless access first. And then there are a lot of challenges, and there's still a lot to overcome on the really on the component side to enable a handset for millimeter wave. Is, as you said, it's an extreme challenge. And so towers and things are going to have to do, you know, beamforming and beam steering and really intelligent management of not just spraying RF in a big circle and hoping you catch everybody that's in there, but more smartly monitoring that and steering those transmit beams to specific locations to do what you said, to pinpoint users and to more accurately and more reliably connect to them. That's still, we see as a ways down the road yet for true fully mobile 5G and millimeter wave.
Jeff, I think you're shattering the dreams of some of our audience. We've got Webster in our chat room right now who's saying, I thought 5G was low Earth orbit, which I guess technically you could do it, but we're running into something that we did with 4G and even a little bit with 3G before, which is 4G didn't really mean anything. 4G was just sort of like, it's faster. 5G actually does mean something, right? I mean, they are actually developing it into a standard, into a set of technologies. Yeah. Can you tell me the difference when you look at 4G and the mess that that was and what they're trying to do with 5G? Are they actually correcting that?
Unfortunately, we see a little bit of the same, right? There are a lot of rushes. You'll hear, you know, there's multiple network trials going on by the carriers today. And really it's being done in two ways. So as you mentioned, 5G is a spec and it does offer a lot of performance enhancements over 4G. So, you know, for example, you're going to get 10 gigabit plus, you know, data rate. So, you know, improved over today's 4G, you know, there's demos of up to a gigahertz peaks. And so you're going to see, you know, much greater data throughput. But it's also in things like lower latency is a huge performance improvement, you know, less than a millisecond latency versus 50 milliseconds that you see today. We can talk a little bit about what that means in real applications. But it's also in the number of users and things like that. And so 5G, it's a spec. And so all the carriers are using the spectrum that they have to accomplish that. And as you mentioned, you know, millimeter wave is a little bit further out, and there's a lot of people scrambling to do that. There's a lot of, you know, physics challenges to overcome. But there's also, you know, carriers are using existing spectrum to still meet the start of that 5G promise. And, you know, T-Mobile is probably one of them, right? They have a large holding of 600 megahertz spectrum. And when they announce, you know, nationwide 5G rollouts this year, that's going to be done with their 600 megahertz spectrum holdings. And, you know, Sprint's another one in a unique position. They have a unique 2.5 gigahertz band, and, you know, they get that to themselves. And so they'll be using, you know, that spectrum for the initial deployments of their 5G. And so, like I said, we see it in two different sort of breakpoints. Sub 6 gigahertz is really spectrum that's available today that will be started to look more like 5G as far as performance goes. But the real, you know, full specification of 5G will be met with millimeter wave. And again, we see that as more of a 2020 starts as fixed wireless access. And then will, as handsets and other things become, you know, more developed, we'll move into a truly mobile environment at some point.
Jeff, who do you see as the leader in millimeter right now? Is it Intel? Is it Broadcom?
Well, I think it starts with, you know, Ericsson was one of the leaders. So at the macro site, you know, Ericsson and Nokia, you know, as far as the air interface goes, as far as the cellular side, have a lot. Huawei overseas in Asia is another big player, obviously. And then on the network side, you know, our specialty is, I'd have to claim a little bit of ignorance. You know, I focus a lot on the over-the-air standard, so I'm really more the air interface, you know, part of it. And then there's, you know, 5G has a lot of implications on backhaul and RAN and network slicing and all those things that really get into the core network as well.
All right. Now, let's take more of a macro vision here right now. Let's go up to 10,000 feet. Because a lot of people are waiting for 5G on their handsets. That's what they wanted. It's, oh my goodness, they see the demos at Mobile World Congress and they want that. It looks awesome, especially, and hopefully you can expand on this a little bit later, that low latency. That low latency is so attractive when you're dealing with demanding interactive data operations. However, as you mentioned at the start of your presentation here, that's not where we're going to see it first. We're going to see it in fixed, in point to point. I mean, yes, you can provide some great throughput with fixed antennas, with beam steering antennas that will go to a fixed point, say a fixed building. And from there, maybe you go to older technologies. Maybe you go to Wi-Fi. Maybe you go out to cell in frequencies that you own. That's going to be the first step, right? I mean, from there, what kind of technical innovation do you need to make to actually get to the ubiquitous 5G on a mobile handset?
Well, I think there's two things. You know, first you have to have handsets that are capable of millimeter wave. And so, you know, the front end RF portion of, you know, power amplifiers, the digital control of those, antennas and all those things, you know, there's going to be, you know, array antennas and things like that. They're dramatically different than what a cellular antenna is today. So handsets are going to have to come a little bit further in the development side. But then as a base station goes as well, you know, there'll have to be things, like you said, you know, beam steering and that. And so there's going to be a fair amount of development to take place yet to get truly mobile. And then, as we said, you know, the propagation is a lot less. And so if you look at the way your towers are spaced today, you know, the operators can't simply hang, you know, millimeter wave radios on those existing towers. That'll be a start. But some of what we've heard and understand is that each cell site would have to be much more dense. And so they're going to have to overlay, you know, picocells and other smaller radios inside of that base station network. And we've heard on as much, depending on the density, as much as, you know, 10 to 1. So for every one base station tower, you may have up to 10, you know, small cell or picocell radios inside that base station service area to really be able to provide continuous millimeter wave coverage. So, you know, there's a lot of things to overcome. But as you can see, there's also a tremendous amount of economic impact, you know, that's going to be generated by this as well.
Yeah, one of the things that I keep hearing has to happen in a market like North America and the United States is you have to see a lot more inter-carrier cooperation than we get right now. I mean, they already have towers that have all the carriers on them, but you're going to need a lot more of that. There's going to be no such thing as a 5G deployment for T-Mobile versus a 5G mobile for Verizon, because none of them are going to be able to afford that. When you are looking at the kind of density that you need for a proper 5G deployment, it's kind of everyone has to be in the same boat, right? I mean, otherwise the tops of our roofs would be nothing but antennas.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, a couple weeks ago, the FCC just had a vote on several initiatives. And I think one of them was, you know, the ease of deployment and approving sites for small cells. And I think that's one of the things we've heard for several years was that, you know, in order to provide better coverage with today's equipment, that, you know, cities and municipalities were going to be, you know, you're going to have radios on light posts and things all around densely populated urban areas, and it was going to be great. You're going to have continuous coverage. And then you run into the real challenges of, you know, sort of government regulation and site approvals and permitting and power and backhaul and all those things. So, yeah, you're right. The interoperability as well as the cooperation to minimize the amount of time it's going to take to get all the permitting and right of way to get these radios installed is a challenge. And I think the FCC and others are really trying to move along a path of helping to streamline that process. But yeah, you can imagine how long it takes to get a cell tower put up in a municipality, and then imagine, you know, 10 for every one of those is going to have to be deployed at some point. It's a challenge.
Yeah. Now, and everyone's going to have to start to learn how to play nice if they want this deployment to work properly. Let's take a step back into the technology a little bit, because I want to go through this latency issue, because this is huge for me. As you said, maybe 50 milliseconds for a standard 4G deployment, 1 millisecond for millimeter radio technologies. Why is the latency so much lower?
Well, in the millimeter wave frequencies and in the processing time, they're able to do, you know, much faster transit times to the device and then back to the device again. And so, you know, as I said, you know, today's networks are roughly 50 milliseconds, and that's going to drop down a millisecond. And so, you know, you think about things like autonomous driving and all the other use cases that really need to have that for them to function, not ignoring things like augmented reality and things like that, too.
Yeah. And that brings me to the other point, which is this makes 5G so much more suited for the more interesting Internet of Things applications, because when you can actually get real-time information, real-time sensor data, not slightly delayed, it becomes infinitely more usable. Is 5G made for IoT?
That is really the big use case that I know the carriers, several that we've talked to, that they're really excited about. And yeah, there are some key drivers to 5G that really enable, I think, a massive growth in IoT. And there's McKinsey and others, they have some really huge predictions. You see a lot of those hockey stick kinds of things. But, you know, they predict anywhere from, I think it's $3 to $11 trillion in economic spending on IoT by the year 2025. Cellular connected IoT devices, you know, in the billions now. There's, I think, roughly 100 and some million IoT devices or M2M in the U.S. today. But, you know, that's going to grow into the billions. And so, yeah, those are really what the carriers are excited about. When you think about it, you know, the saturation point of handsets, right? When in the U.S., where you're more than 1-to-1 as far as number of connections or connected devices per population. And so it's really hard to grow that as a carrier. How do you expand your business? And so, you know, when you can do multiples of those on connected things, that is really where the opportunity for growth is. And I said, there's some really key performance metrics that enables IoT as well.
One last question before I bring my co-host back in for a final panel discussion. And that is to talk about IPv6. Now, people have been assuming that since this is going to be a new technology, we're not even going to enable it for IPv4. It doesn't make sense to dual stack that equipment anymore, because anything that's going to be using 5G is going to be new, so you might as well go with IPv6. Is this actually the case? Are we finally going to say goodbye to any semblance of IPv4?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's a little bit of a weak area for me. I've talked to several folks too. You know, as I said, we focus more on the air interface side, but I mean, when we talk about the IoT, right? And now the number of devices are in the billions. You know, whether or not all of those have a unique address or not, is, I think it really comes down to the pure limitation of, you know, number of available addresses in IPv4 versus 6. And at some point, you know, it's going to have to migrate that way. And 5G just, you know, orders of magnitude more connected things is at some point going to kind of dictate that. But I really don't have the answer, unfortunately, today on the whole switchover point.
I'm disappointed. I was told that you knew everything. You were omnipotent in 5G.
I always have to leave everybody hoping for a little bit more, right?
All right, let's go ahead and bring our co-host back in here. Lou, Curtis, you've been listening to the discussion. I've been watching you nodding your heads over in the preview monitor. For you, when you think of 5G and when you think of starting an enterprise-level deployment, Curtis, let's start with you. What are the bullet point items? What are the things that you can sell to that C-suite executive?
Well, I think the things that you'll be able to sell, it depends. Because on the one hand, yes, you're going to have lower latency, greater bandwidth, all of those good things. And that's wonderful. But everything that I'm seeing and hearing tells me that for several years, at least, the majority of this is going to be an improved bandwidth situation in already provisioned areas. This is not going to be something that allows dramatically greater access to remote offices way out in the sticks. This is not something where if you are, for example, an insurance company who has agents in little towns everywhere, that 5G is going to solve all of your bandwidth and connectivity problems. But I do think, especially for warehousing, for various kinds of, sorry, the word is going away, surveillance in already populated areas, 5G could make a huge difference. And I think if I were in the C-suite, or if I were making a pitch to the C-suite, my pitch right now would be to go ahead and start talking to my providers now to lay the groundwork for building some solid competitive contracts moving forward when 5G finally is deployed.
Yeah. And very, very minimum, I'd be looking at the point-to-point as a redundant connection option, because it's going to be lower price than any sort of dedicated landline. But that would be an easy sell. And then from that, you can move over to, oh, and by the way, we can now do branch connections for far less and far more secure. And it's basically like a leased connection. We own it. No one else is on that. I think that's language that maybe they can understand. Although, I don't know, Curtis, I've been out of the C-suite for a while, so I'm hoping that they've at least maintained their level of intelligence. Yes?
It's a lovely thought. it's a lovely thought. And I think, Amanda, with your day job, it behooves you to hold on to that thought. But I think ultimately it comes down to the money. So the lower cost, that's compelling. The security in some deployments could be compelling. Ultimately, though, it's going to come down to dollars and cents. And something tells me that we're going to see a lot of the landlines find new bottoms to their pricing model once 5G starts rolling out.
Yeah, indeed. And actually, Jeff, we do have a question from our chat room, again from Webster, who wanted to know about the security. I mean, when we're talking about 5G, are we just talking about a transport layer here? Or is there security that's going to be baked into the technology that would make my leased line, my leased fixed line, inherently more secure than, say, just throwing it over unlicensed spectrum?
Yeah, that's a good question. That is one of the benefits of cellular, right? It is a very secure connection. You know, the connection from a tower to your handset is encrypted, and you really can't interfere with that. And so anytime you can stay off of a public network or any way around that, obviously you're going to have a more secure connection. And so a truly all over the air interface with 5G will just reduce the opportunity for somebody to get into your connection because you're over some public network or a switch or something somewhere.
Right, right. Speaking of that, Lou, your company, as we covered in the blips, has announced some wonderful IoT things. They're going to be spending $5 billion over the next 4 years. They've also increased the number of plans that are available for Azure IoT Hub. So I'm assuming Microsoft is a little interested in 5G, right?
Just a bit. I think that's the key, is like the IoT, the whole concept of edge computing is the fact that you have these low resource, low energy, you know, energy efficient devices that sit on the edge of computing. And then you stick on AI machine learning on these things, you know, the new Banzai algorithms and so on. And then you supplement that with data from a network, and that network is energy efficient and it's high speed and low latency. Now you have potential for even more billions of microcontrollers that sit out there in the industry that can supplement things for healthcare and security and networking and surveillance and all these things. So the potential is actually sky's the limit. And so that's why companies, especially IoT companies, are looking forward to the 5G, especially if they're able to achieve such the characteristics of the 5G network, especially from the energy efficiency because of IoT devices. They're low quality devices, 2 kilobytes of RAM, 16 megahertz. But again, they can process things quite efficiently, especially from an energy perspective. So I think that this is going to be a key thing, some of the future technologies for sure.
Right. Jeff, let me ask you this. Who in your mind is betting against 5G? Who doesn't want 5G? Whose industry is going to be disrupted by 5G?
Well, if you think about it, right, the race is always who owns the pipe to the consumer. And so we talked about it, you know, if you can replace or give fiber type performance with a cellular, connection, then obviously anybody with fixed wired you know, business models are going to, as Curtis, I believe, said, you know, are going to find new bottoms to the pricing models. And so, you know, you can bundle a lot of services when you have a broader pipe. And, you know, so if you have a fixed cable connection to your home and a cellular connection at some point, if you can get everything serviced through a wireless connection, you know, that's pretty compelling. So I wouldn't point out specific names, but I'd be looking at, obviously, cable operators have a big competitive threat for consumers if, you know, when this really starts to get going.
And actually, a corollary to that, really good question out of our chat room, RJP421 wants to know about RF congestion. We talk about this a lot on the show because, well, when we were talking about Wi-Fi, because we talk about the physics of RF energy. There's only so much RF energy you can pump into any given sky before it becomes saturated. Millimeter wave specialty technology, not as affected by that. Why is that?
Well, as you mentioned, right, so they're more intelligently, and a lot of the millimeter wave networks, you know, because of the limitation in its propagation, then there's a lot more, as you talked earlier about, you know, beam steering and things like that, beam forming. And so these intelligent networks will be able to really manage the network, understand where the traffic is, and then through beam steering and beam forming, you know, instead of just, as I said, putting out a big, you know, sectorized coverage of RF, they'll start to beam form those and then beam steer them so that there's less just overall noise and energy being propagated out, and it'll be more localized. And so that is one of the bigger advantages of millimeter wave.
Right. And we always talk about that when we talk about a dense deployment, because with a dense deployment, you can deal with much shorter transmission paths. You can deal with much lower transmission powers because everything's closer together. And when you do that, it means that RF limitation, the amount of energy you can pump into the sky, isn't as big of a problem anymore because our energy is just not there, which we like. If you could give us a scenario, because we are running out of time, if you could give us a scenario of what you think the deployment of 5G is going to look like, what are the big signposts that we as the consumers and as business owners should be looking at to say, okay, it's maturing now?
Great question. So I think what you'll see in 2020 is you'll see this more deployment of more consumer level or consumer grade devices to the home. And so when you see that, I think you'll be able to really start to gauge that, you know, the macro network is starting to get built out. And again, it's really going to be an ROI use case. And so it's going to be focused first on dense urban areas where there is a lot of congestion today. And then mobile, as far as the consumer goes, I see that as still beyond 2020 before you really start to have something truly mobile in more millimeter wave, aside from just specific spectrum holdings that like T-Mobile has at 600. So, you know, when you start to see typical consumer names offering you access points for your house that has a cellular connection to it, it's real and it's here. And there are several that are practicing with those right now.
Fantastic. We have been speaking with Jeff Gudevich. He is the Chief Product Officer for Wilson Electronic. Jeff, this was a lot of fun. I actually want to have you back at some point, although I'm not host of this show for that much longer. Hopefully we can get you back because I love discussing new technologies with someone who obviously understands them. If you could please tell the audience where they can find you, where they can find Wilson Electronics, where they can find the products that you offer, and maybe find your thoughts on the future of 5G.
Yeah, great. Thanks for that opportunity. So, yes, we also, you know, Wilson Electronics operates our consumer brand. Most of you might know is called WeBoost. So if you go to WeBoost.com, you'll see, thank you, there on a webpage, and you'll see all of our product information, tips. You'll have where to buy, the different categories of products, as well as Wilson Pro and WeBoost.com and our YouTube channel. You'll see a lot of informative videos. We do a lot about, you know, informing folks on just this cellular in general. And so you can find us at both WeBoost.com and WilsonPro.com.
Fantastic. Again, Jeff Gudevich, I want to thank you so very much for being part of this episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity. I was glad to spend time with you.
Folks, you've done it again. You've used up another hour to listen to the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. That's according to 9 out of 10 microcells. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible. Of course, to Jeff, to our wonderful guest, but also to my co-hosts. I couldn't do the show without them. Let's go ahead and start with you, Curtis. What are you up to? Where can people find your work? And, well, what do you want for Christmas?
Well, let's see. As to where they can find me, I'm writing every day over at Dark Reading. Please find me there. If you want to know what I'm writing there, then you can follow me on Twitter, KG4GWA. And this coming week, I am getting ready to head off to San Francisco the week following for the big RSA conference, which is going to be a big deal. Later on this spring, I'll be at conferences for SAP. There's Sapphire Live. I'll be at Cisco Live. It's going to be a busy time, of course, leading up to things like Black Hat and DEF CON. Later on, Ignite, Gartner. It's just going to be a lot of me getting out in the world, hoping to see people from the Twilight Riot. As for what I want for Christmas, at this point, all my stuff in a new house would be a great gift. Padre, I hear you know folks. If you could put in a word for me, I'd appreciate it.
I think I could take care of that. I think we got that covered. By the way, I think I'm definitely joining you on DEF CON Black Hat. I will be at Microsoft Build, I believe, this year, and maybe Ignite. And I believe Lou, I'm going to talk to Lou in a bit, but I think Lou promised that he could get me the treehouse so we can film something in there, because I ain't leaving that campus until I see that. Curtis, always a pleasure, my friend.
Thank you, Padre.
Lou, what about you? First of all, treehouse, right? Treehouse.
We're going to do the treehouse. We're going to do the Amazon Dome, too.
I see. These are things I like to hear. I'm actually going to be staying at Seattle University, so it'll be a bit of a commute, but should be fun. But not enough about that. What about you? Where can people find you? Where can people find your division? And where can people find all your Jiren-like strength?
Well, you can always find me on Twitter at Lou Amam. And of course, all the work that I do on Office is the Office Developer Group and extensibility team on dev.office.com. And of course, check out May 7th. Build's coming. We're going to be debuting a bunch of cool things and some really neat things going on. And of course, check out the developer program for Office, because we want to start promoting. Get a developer account, subscription, Office 365, all some bunch of cool things. So check that out.
Fantastic. And folks, we also want to thank everyone who makes this show possible here. Well, that means Lisa and Leo, who have allowed us to continue doing this show all these years. It means our engineers, who make sure everything is plugged in and pointed in the right direction. It means the people like, Kevin, who push the buttons properly. Kevin, this is that time of the show where, I'm normally going to ask you a question. I want to give you a little bit of time before we go into our regular sign-off stuff, because I really want you to get this one right. I want you to think IPv4 and IPv6. So that's going to be your hint. Now, while Kevin thinks about that, let me remind you that you can always find our show and all of its back episodes at our show page. Just go to twit.tv/twiet. That's T-W-I-E-T. There you're going to find those back episodes along with the show notes. And you're also going to find a place to subscribe. If you want to support the show, you can get an audio version, a video version, or a high-definition video version automatically delivered into your device of choice. Again, just go to twit.tv/twiet. Also, don't forget that you can find me on Twitter. Just go to twitter.com/PadreSJ. When you're there, you're going to find out where I am in the world, and where I probably got sick the last time, because I tend to get sick every time I get on a plane. It's kind of annoying. Oh, by the way, there's a little garden in our studio there with the angry hippo eating Doctor Who, because we're a bunch of kids. That's right. Also, please, 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 please don't forget to drop by every time we do this show, Fridays at 1:30 p.m. Pacific time. Until next time, I am Father Robert Ballasaire. Wait, oh, I'm sorry. The question. Kevin, could you have your mic on, please?
I almost thought you were going to forget about me.
But all right. Looking at IPv6, which is something that we discussed during the show, means that we might possibly move past IPv4, which has 4 what's as its address base?
Internet protocols.
We were looking for octets, Kevin. We were looking for octets. Oh, well.
What is that? It looks...
Never mind. Maybe you'll get it next time. Until then, I'm Father Robert Ballasaire, the Digital Jesuit, just reminding you that if you want to know what's going on in the Enterprise, just keep quiet.